This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak to Dr. Piero Antonio, who's an MD and is at the University of Wisconsin. Welcome to Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Hello.
What's your position there officially?
I'm a professor of neurology.
Okay.
And pharmacology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And I'm a director of the Memory Disorders Clinic.
Okay, so you do both research and clinical work?
That's right.
And how do they interact with each other? How do you combine or synergize what you do clinically and research-wise?
Well, very closely, because the type of research we do is called clinical research, which means it's primarily applied to patients, caregivers, and so forth. So, for instance, when we talk about development of drugs, we look at this problem not so much from the lab point of view in the development of a drug compound, but actually in the implementation, in the usage, to see if it's safe and well-tolerated and efficacious. Also, we do studies with imaging using MRIs to find if there is something peculiar, people who either have dementia or who are at risk for developing of dementia. And again, we use family members and patients who have dementia. So it's a very clinically oriented type of research we do.
And in fact, the data you get from the clinical research comes back into the studies that you write up?
Yes, in a certain way, we are basically, I would say, the last stage of research in Alzheimer's disease when the ideas or when the development of new techniques or drugs are actually applied in the clinical setting.
Okay.
To test to see if they actually work or not.
All right. I know it's a complicated question, but what could you say concisely about what we know now about what causes Alzheimer's? And I guess we have to go one step back from that as to what's the distinguishing characteristics of Alzheimer's? How do we know that someone has it, and what do we know about what causes it?
Probably get a Nobel Prize.
Right.
Meaning it's a relatively complex disease, unlike other neurological diseases. It's a disease that probably before we actually make a diagnosis. It presents with subtle changes in memory, which can show itself either with forgetfulness, with missing appointments, for instance. It really varies depending on what's one everyday life type of activities.
Are the symptoms that present essentially those that show the failure to form short-term memories?
That is correct. So what happens is that it's the recent events which are not retained. In fact, that's almost a diagnostic feature of Alzheimer's disease, is the fact that the problem is in laying down new memory traces.
Right.
While the information acquired in the past is very well remembered.
So it's essentially the difference between on a computer that the RAM memory isn't holding, but the hard drive is still there.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay.
So because of this problem, therefore, it shows itself primarily in absent-mindedness and forgetfulness as an initial symptom, but not always.
Right.
And then eventually it has a very slow, gradual, insidious progression. So sometimes looking back, it's common to say, well, these problems might have started a year ago, but at that time we were thinking that the person was stressed, was tired, was depressed, had
right.
medical concerns.
And so, in fact, it's very hard to distinguish a year before it becomes more serious whether the symptoms there are precursors of future Alzheimer's developments or whether they're, as you just said, they're caused by other factors.
Exactly. Sometimes we see people diagnosed with depression, and
right.
then it becomes apparent that when they start to become forgetful for words, then this problem is extending from memory to other intellectual domains, such as language, ability to drive, ability to prepare a meal. Then we realize that this is a more global intellectual neurological problem.
Okay.
The diagnosis becomes quite obvious at that point.
All right. Now, it's obvious then that what scientists are going to want to do is trace back the observable behavioral and psychological symptoms to physiological causes, right?
That's correct.
And what's the latest thinking on what those physiological changes are that generate these psychological results?
Okay, there's some identified changes in the brain, and these changes apparently are present even in a clinical silent manner in people who most likely do not have the diagnosis yet. In other words, these lesions seem to appear in the brain probably a long time before we actually make the diagnosis. And these lesions are primarily, we can summarize them in the accumulation of some abnormal proteins in the brain, which are now the target of pharmacological interventions.
Now, this is the famous plaque, right?
This is the famous plaque, which is formed by this abnormal protein called amyloid protein.
Right.
There's another protein called neurofibrillary tangle, which is probably a consequence of the accumulation of amyloid protein, or a separate lesion that comes in parallel with the amyloid protein. We don't know.
Okay.
But they're both sort of candidates for probably one of the earliest changes in Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, so those changes take place, they remain subclinical for a while, and then they surface and start causing symptoms. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yes, the brain has tolerance, has brain reserve, so we accumulate these lesions in the brain, but you don't see anything at the clinical level. Only some of us eventually will reach a point that these lesions may cause clinical signs of cognitive impairment or dementia, as we call it.
Is part of that because there's redundant capacity in the brain, and if part of the capacity is undermined by the plaque, other areas take over, but after a while there's just not enough redundancy and then the symptoms come up?
Yes, there is some sort of compensatory mechanism because of the redundancy that we call brain reserve.
Right.
So that if it could be actually just a very simple thing related to brain size. That is, if you have a larger brain,
right,
you accumulate more plaques over a certain space.
Right.
On the other hand, if you have other neurological problems, whether strokes, hypertension, diabetes, things which might have weakened the brain, maybe even trauma. Maybe trauma happened decades earlier.
Right.
Well, then one's brain reserve is reduced. Therefore, you may not need that many plaques and tangles to cause the disease, but you may need much fewer ones. So because you have consumed, let's say, your redundancy or brain reserve to fight this accumulation of plaques. You know, plaques are a relatively common phenomenon with aging. Around half the people at age 50 already start showing some evidence of plaques accumulation in the brain, but not necessarily half of the population become a percentage.
Okay, I think when we talk about healthy brains towards the end here, we're going to maybe talk about how you essentially can protect or enhance your reserves, right?
Yes.
Okay. Are you on a cell phone that's dropping out occasionally?
No, on a fixed line.
Okay, because there seems to be some little gaps here. It could be telephony plaque, it seems like.
Maybe contagious.
Yes. All right. So are there ways to detect these tangles and amyloids before there are symptoms visible?
Not really. From a research point of view, there are attempts made to develop imaging techniques which can somehow visualize the accumulation of this abnormal protein.
Right, essentially add a dye marker or something that would adhere to these and then show up somehow.
That's right. And there's two laboratories who are conducting work in this direction.
Right.
And preliminary results seem to be quite encouraging because there's definite visualization of these accumulation of plaques in people with Alzheimer's disease. And the next step would be to apply this technique not to people who already have a diagnosis, because it may be superfluous information. We already know clinically what's going on. But maybe people who may be at higher risk of contracting this disease because they have, let's say, a parent with this disease.
Right.
Or because they carry certain genes which seem to place people at higher risk.
Right.
And these people could have this test done not when they're 70 or 80, but they could have it when they're 40 or 50.
Okay.
To see if they may have a larger plaque load than somebody else at the same age, and therefore these people could be then candidates for prevention of Alzheimer's disease, whether it's with pharmacological intervention or other kind of strategies, a vaccine, for instance, or whatever science may be providing us with.
Right. Now, in fact, of course, the point of finding whether people are predisposed or are in the early stages is only useful if there's going to be an intervention that's going to allow you to do something. I want to talk about that next, but I just wanted to go back one more step.
Sure.
You mentioned genetic and familial elements here. What's the current thinking on whether there's just an Alzheimer's gene or whether there are 50 or 60 different genes that predispose in different ways and different aspects, so that how much is genetics involved here?
Okay. Well, if there's two types, clinically speaking, of Alzheimer's disease, that what we commonly refer to as early onset and late onset.
Okay.
Early onset is the more dramatic one, the one that happens in people who may be 50 or 40 or even younger.
Right.
And definitely that form of the disease seems to have a very strong genetic contribution.
Right.
If not totally genetic.
Right.
Although we don't know exactly which genes are involved. We know we have identified some,
right,
but the great majority of these families, which represent only 1 or 2% of all people with Alzheimer's disease, have definitely a genetic cause of the disease.
And in fact, are there what I guess are called markers that would show that someone has the predisposition to that early onset version?
Yes, you can actually measure certain genes which have been identified as causing hereditary Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
But there are many families where the disease is hereditary, but those genes are just fine. That tells us that this is a polygenetic disease.
Right.
There are many genes that can modulate the chance of getting this condition.
Okay.
If we look at the more common variety, the Alzheimer's disease that happens after age 65, there is a familial tendency, but it's not a genetic transmission which can be mathematically calculated.
Right.
And in that case, we know most likely there are some genes which predispose towards the disease, and not just one, but several. And there are some genes that probably protect us from the disease.
Okay.
And therefore, we have this kind of mixture of plus and minuses that can determine if we are, if we're not getting the disease. But in the late onset, it seems that also lifelong factors, lifelong experiences and so forth may also be an important modulator in the chance of getting the disease.
So essentially with early onset, genetics plays a more important role than it does in late onset.
Definitely.
Okay. And where would you put Alzheimer's in the sort of hierarchy or spectrum of disease, continuum of diseases, in terms of which the genetic elements are being examined with a view towards treatment or vaccine or other kinds of measures in terms of other diseases? Is it pretty much a leader or a follower, or sort of somewhere in the middle there in terms of that type of research?
I would say definitely it's a disease where their entire laboratory is dedicating into the development of the study of the genetics of Alzheimer's disease, with the idea of finding a specific abnormal protein which could be eventually, quote-unquote, fixed somehow.
So I would say
it's a leading area of research.
Okay, so the idea then is if you can find the polygenetic sources of the disease and then knock out, modify, or otherwise intervene with those genes,
yes,
then there'll be a treatment along those lines.
Yes, but it's apparent already that compared to other neurological diseases, for instance, Parkinson's or, for instance, Huntington's,
right,
in Alzheimer's disease, there are many genes involved. It's not just one target of genes that we need to find.
Right.
And that, in a certain way, it's a frustrating disease to deal with.
Right.
Because probably if in the close future we're going to have a genetic intervention,
right,
for any neurological disease, probably it's not going to be Alzheimer's disease. It's going to be probably Parkinson's or the other ones I've mentioned.
Right. No, I don't want to get too far afield, but Parkinson's is a failure of the brain to produce dopamine, right?
Yes.
How narrowed in is the research now to find out what it is genetically that interferes with that production of dopamine?
Okay. There is a gene identified in Parkinson's disease which is linked very much with the disease itself.
Right.
It's a single neurotransmitter abnormality,
right,
that affects specific neurons which cause the disease. In Alzheimer's disease, we have many neurotransmitters, many centers of the brain which show changes, loss of brain cells, and is not restricted to one specific system or pathway.
Right.
And because of that, even the genetics is similarly complicated and sort of
Exactly. In fact, there's a pretty straight correlation between how complicated the origins are and how complicated the genetics are, for obvious reasons. Okay. I want to, before we get to more specific issues, maybe we get even a little more philosophical here. What do you see as the and we've just distinguished between Parkinson's is a kind of a relatively simple neurological disease, Alzheimer's is a relatively complicated one. What's the function of Alzheimer's? Why is there Alzheimer's? How does evolution and genetics allow something like that to develop?
That's interesting, because most likely Alzheimer's disease is a peculiar human disease. Animals generally in the wild don't become demented.
Right.
And if they do, they're eaten up right away, I guess.
Right.
I would say in the explosion of Alzheimer's disease over the last 25 years is probably due to increased number of people who live longer.
Right.
And just like the cardiovascular system was the first, was the more common cause of death when average lifespan was in the 50s and 60s, now that we are extending basically lifespan for the majority of us, we are realizing that basically there is this disease or brain failure, as suggesting that probably the brain has not been engineered to maybe live this long.
That's right. Essentially, the body is and the brain are able to continue for a while, but this is uncharted territory for this many people. In other words, it wasn't necessary for evolution to program for this before, because not many people live that long.
That is correct. So basically, we would die of infectious disease.
Right.
And then when we treated those, we discovered degenerative cardiovascular diseases, atherosclerosis, and now we are kind of sort of getting a handle on those and cancer. And as we're living longer, we're realizing that there is this sort of brain failure that happens as we get to live in their 80s.
Right.
So that approximately 40% of people around age 85 or so have some sort of cognitive decline, most likely dementia of the Alzheimer's type.
So in a sense, it's the fact that there's such an explosion of Alzheimer's is a tribute to the evolution of medicine as a way of preserving people's lives long enough for this
yes.
failure to appear.
Yes, I would say the reason why when I started getting involved in Alzheimer's disease in the 70s, it was an extremely rare disease,
right.
unknown, and we had probably one case every 2 years that we could find and study.
Right.
And now it's become extremely common, is simply because of demographics.
Okay.
There are many more people around, especially women who tend to live longer,
right.
who expose themselves to this age-related disease.
Right. Does that mean that it's more the increased longevity rather than more mercury in the air, more air pollution, or other environmental factors that has caused the increase in the incidence of the disease? Or is that also, are those also factors, possibly?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question, except to say that definitely longevity has a significant part of that.
Right.
And I would say that the lifelong exposure to diseases, or the lifelong, exposure to certain lifestyle choices might modulate the chance of getting this disease, or might actually induce the disease. We don't know exactly
right.
the answer to that question, but I think it's a combination of both.
Okay, speaking of demography, have neurological epidemiologists found populations in hidden Shangri-La valleys where people routinely live to be 90 and don't get dementia of any kind? And have they investigated that?
I'm not aware of specific studies of that type.
Okay.
Generally, but you're correct that, you know, finding areas where people have more or less
right.
Alzheimer's disease may be a clue what's in that environment that may protect or cause the illness. There are studies that are looking specifically at, the distribution of the disease within different populations around the world, for
right.
instance, or in different communities, for
right.
instance. So there are some interesting studies. One is the Nunn study, which looks at
right.
is Alzheimer's disease more common in a community of retired sisters compared to the general population.
What did they find?
They found that the incidence is relatively similar.
Right.
But it was easy to find some correlations with other factors that could determine why certain sisters had Alzheimer's disease versus others who did not. For instance, those who seem to have a higher problems with cerebral atherosclerosis were at higher risk of developing also dementia of the Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
Also, for instance, those sisters who had less education or less ability with language when they were in the early 20s seemed to have a higher correlation with Alzheimer's disease 50, 60, 70 years later
right.
when they passed away, suggesting that there must be something throughout life that may predispose or protect from getting this disease.
Right, okay. Now, having established, I think, a very useful sort of general context of why and how this happens, what can we say about the overall view of what the treatment modalities are intended to do? Essentially, what you're trying to do is research the causes and see what maybe might be genetically engineered one way or another to eliminate it. But in the meantime, people who are getting it, what are the various interventions that are available for them now?
Yes. Well, the emphasis of treating people with Alzheimer's disease focus on what's referred to as the symptomatic treatment. That is, we don't have anything that treats the disease, gets rid of it, but we have interventions that can improve or hide or postpone the presence of symptoms, whether they are behavior or whether they are symptoms due to clearly cognitive intellectual dysfunction.
So it's essentially a palliative treatment. Treat the symptoms, but there's not really anything that can be done yet to get at the core
the
problem.
Of disease. Exactly. So that the approved drugs on the market to help memory and cognitive function,
right,
what they do is, as you mentioned, do not necessarily extend life of the person with dementia, but improve the symptoms so that the quality of life for a period of time, which may vary from patient to patient, is improved.
Okay, and what's the mechanism by which they do that? Do they wash out the plaque? Do they substitute for the neurological deficits that's created by the plaque? Or what's exactly the mechanism by which these, to the extent that it's known, that these treatments work?
Yeah, the approved drugs so far work because they seem to increase the level of a chemical in the brain which is generally thought to be used in processes of attention, concentration, and memory called acetylcholine.
Oh.
And so these drugs primarily increase the tone of these chemicals which are somehow used through the brain synapses or connections,
right, they create,
to form memories.
Right, they create more acetylcholine or make it more effective, or what exactly do they do?
They prevent the elimination of the drug.
They block the uptake of it?
they block the elimination of this drug once it's released by the nerve terminal.
It's a little bit what Prozac and other antidepressants do with serotonin.
Exactly. It modulates the release of the drugs at the synaptic cleft by increasing the tone of the acetylcholine.
And that means that while the deleterious effects of the plaque are still in place, you've essentially turned up the volume on its antagonist so that the overall effect tries to approach normal.
Exactly. So the plaques will continue to be there, will continue to cause neuronal loss, but those fewer neurons that are there are probably squeezing out more chemicals through the action of these drugs.
Okay, now are these drugs specifically, is Aricept one of those drugs?
Aricept is one of them, yes.
Okay, and it works the way we've just discussed.
That's right.
Now, Namenda is another newer drug, and it's generically memantine. Does it,
yes,
work the same way or by a different mechanism?
No, memantine works differently. The drug basically modulates a receptor for glutamate, which is another chemical used by the brain for memory processes.
Right.
And what happens in Alzheimer's disease, as well as other conditions like epilepsy and stroke,
right,
there's a release of glutamate in those neurons which are diseased, and this chronic activity of glutamate ends up damaging the nerve cell and eventually causing it to die.
Right.
Memantine, by blocking the receptors to glutamate, protects the neuron from this chronic activation, this chronic stimulation.
Right.
And by doing so, it is postulated, and this is, again, a mechanism which has never really been documented in Alzheimer's patients, but we think that this is how it works. It will allow the neurons to live longer.
Okay. And it works. So now, is there then a synergistic benefit from taking Aricept and Namenda?
Yes. There's one study which combined the two drugs, and it shows that the two drugs together do better than one that Aricept alone.
And so, is that the generally prescribed combination for people with Alzheimer's now?
Yes. Well, there's not a specific guideline in how to use these drugs in combination.
Right.
But I would say, clinically, my experience is that a very large number of people are taking both medications based on the findings of this study that show the combination seems to help people better than just one of the two drugs.
And that's essentially because they work on in different ways. They don't really enhance each other, but together they create a better result.
That is correct.
Okay. Right now, what are the major questions that are being investigated in terms of the mechanism of action of the disease and strategies for treating it?
Excuse me, could you repeat that question?
Sure. What are the major questions that are being investigated now? What are you trying to find out that will help you move to the next step in treatment here?
Correct. This is a great question. Because right now we are using drugs, whether those two drugs we mentioned,
right,
cholinomimetic drugs or the memantine-like drug,
right,
to increase levels of neurotransmitters.
Right.
The next step is to use medications which have more direct effect on the brain cell, either by using neurotropic drugs. These are a new family of drugs which are currently being tested, which act almost like hormones,
right,
that is, stimulate the metabolism of the cell,
right,
that therefore the cell can survive longer. So it's not specifically a drug aimed at one specific chemical in the neuron, but rather more eutrophic or supportive or metabolic activity for the brain cell.
Now, is part of the strategy here to dissolve, eliminate, wash out, get rid of the plaque and or interfere with the mechanism that's creating it?
That is yet another line of research.
Okay. These neurotropics, then, that differ from the current treatment modalities, they're essentially trying to generally strengthen the neurons.
Yeah, because many years ago it was discovered that there are some chemicals present in the brain which help the for the brain cell to grow, for instance,
right,
and also to sprout these connections from brain cell to brain cell, almost like wires in an electric system.
Right.
And these chemicals are now being either isolated and re-engineered in a certain way to see if they have this effect on people who clinically have dementia in the way of, can we actually slow down the disease process?
Right. So these are essentially the underpinnings of good neuron health. And by finding out what they are, how they work, and how they might be re-engineered to be even more potently reintroduced, you're trying to just protect the general tone and health of the neurons.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the timetable for that? How is that? Where on the research curve is that?
They are in what you would call stage 2-3 FDA studies. That is, they're actually being tested in a population of people with Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. I spent a lot of this year covering the stem cell debate here in California.
Mm-hmm.
It passed. Stem cells are going to get $300 million in research money every year. What is the likely or possible impact of stem cell research on the treatment of Alzheimer's?
I think there's a lot of hope that this could be another avenue that will make a clinical difference. Somehow tempered by the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, Alzheimer's disease is relatively complex.
Right.
Actually, it's a prototype of a complex disease. So it's very difficult to target either a specific area of the brain or a specific cell that could regenerate or could, in a certain way, stimulate other cells to grow and reverse some of the anatomical changes we see in the brain.
Right. Now, right.
So I think that stem cells definitely will have an important role to play in the neurosciences, and the clinical application in Alzheimer's disease will not be probably the first area where this attempt will be done.
Now, things seem to be moving to the stage with cardiac stem cells that, if I understand the research correctly, stem cells will be engineered. If they're cloned properly, there won't be rejection. People will be able to essentially have injected into their hearts or their circulatory system fresh, new, healthy cardiac cells that will go in and somehow replace
and colonize the heart.
And colonize the heart and presumably take push the bad ones aside and take their place, and then those will be digested and everybody will have a happy young heart. Is that possible with the brain and neural stem cell treatments?
I don't know. It sounds a little bit a bit far-fetched for
right.
neurological diseases,
right?
Because you know, the brain is really protected from the rest of the body with immunologically speaking, and also from a vascular point of view, the blood vessels are different in the brain.
Right.
What may be injected in the vein and distributed through the body does not necessarily go into the brain.
Right.
Is one of the major obstacles in giving any brain active compound.
This is the famous blood-brain barrier.
Blood-brain barrier, yes.
Right.
Therefore, I don't think that it will be very easy to either extrapolate to the brain in general anything we can do to help the liver, the lung, the heart.
Right.
And once we would find a vehicle to get into the brain, you know, and there are many ways of doing that,
right,
by inserting genes or even stem cells. Again, as I said, I think Alzheimer's disease will probably, the researchers will probably wait and see what's been done in some other more simple, more direct neurological diseases. Some genetic diseases of childhood, for instance, could be probably more easily targeted, maybe Parkinson's, and then eventually something will happen in Alzheimer's disease. But I don't think that this is going to be something quite realistic in the immediate 5-10 years.
Okay. Are there any approaches even more novel than the one I've just suggested here that are being considered or even investigated in terms of treatment at
yes.
this point?
I would say the vaccine for Alzheimer's disease is something which a lot of clinicians and researchers in the field are watching very closely, because it's a novel approach which had a false start with some disastrous results
right.
in the clinical experimentation. Now this has been fine-tuned and reintroduced probably next year
right.
with the hope that actually this intervention may reduce the presence of amyloid in the brain of people who have Alzheimer's disease.
What's the general proposition according to which the vaccine would work?
Okay, in Alzheimer's disease, we have this abnormal protein called amyloid protein, which is deposited.
Right.
And this amyloid protein can stimulate the antibodies, which are made by one's body,
right.
To fight it. So the idea is to present to the patient who has Alzheimer's disease this antigen, this abnormal protein,
right.
to stimulate the one's own immunological system to fight it.
So essentially, you'd go in there with a protein that would that the immune system would think is amyloid,
correct.
But really isn't, and it would then rev up its immunological defenses to kill it, and then it would be ready and waiting when the real amyloid came by.
Or maybe it can attack the amyloid that has already been deposited.
Is that meaning that it could eliminate some of it?
Yes, exactly.
So in other words, they'd be trained. The immune system would be trained up or tuned up in order to become stronger against the amyloid plaque.
That is correct. In fact, these experiments have been done, and the people who eventually have died with Alzheimer's disease, once they've looked at their brain, it seems that the amyloid load or the presence of amyloid was unusually decreased in people who received the vaccine.
Okay, and so do you consider that a pretty promising approach?
Yes, I think it needs a lot of fine-tuning. For instance, only a fourth or so of the people who received the vaccine seem to make antibodies.
Right.
It seems that in the attempts done so far, this protein also created antibodies against healthy parts of the brain.
Right.
And therefore some people ended up having what's called meningoencephalitis, which is an infection of the brain.
Because it gets carried away and goes after healthy
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly. Instead of creating too many antibodies for too many things besides
right.
the specific amyloid.
Right. It needs to be fine-tuned so that it only goes after the amyloids.
Exactly. So now they have gone back to the lab, they've looked at the amyloid protein, and they've realized that the active part of the protein is much tinier, much more selective, much
right.
more restricted. So now they're using that as a stimulus for the system to see if that's going to be more selective without having
right.
this cross-reactivity with other parts of the
great.
Brain.
Great. Now, is this along the lines of what are called monoclonal antibodies? Or is that another approach that might be used?
That's a different... the monoclonal antibodies would be actually to give directly antibodies against protein in the vein.
Exactly right.
Yes, that will be yet another possibility. If this way of stimulating the body of it, making its own, is
right.
successful, that will be another alternative.
Okay. Specifically, what are you working on in research right now?
I'm involved primarily in testing in the clinical setting several drugs, or the ones we call the neurotrophic medications,
right.
In people who have Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
We have tested similar drugs in people who have mild cognitive impairment, which is considered a pre-Alzheimer's disease type of situation, where people have not so much dementia or global cognitive changes, but seem to be at higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease because they are more, quote-unquote, absent-minded than the other people of the same age.
Are talking therapies of any use here, or is 98 or more percent of what's going on being done on a chemical basis now?
Chemical basis, for sure.
Okay. What can people do to help prevent, delay, or otherwise interfere with the onset of Alzheimer's?
Okay, remember earlier we discussed that the brain has redundancy and the brain has reserve.
Right.
And I would say that there's a general consensus that if you find ways to protect your redundancy or your brain reserve or your brain in general, you probably have a better chance of either slowing the onset of this disease or making it less severe. That is, if you could prevent high blood pressure, if you can prevent anything that's good for the heart is good for the brain.
Right. Meaning
if you have a good diet, you keep your cholesterol low, if you make sure not to have other conditions such as diabetes, for
instance. Don't smoke cigarettes.
That would be the number one condition. These are all kind of interventions.
Exercise.
Exercise, because exercise improves blood flow through the brain. And if you keep doing this, not so much when, of course, you're 70 and you have a diagnosis of memory problems, but if you do this as a lifestyle throughout your life, you probably reap the benefits when you get to be 70 or 80 because you have a healthier brain.
Right, okay.
So if all of us here accumulate 2 or 3 plaques
right.
every so often and you have a healthy brain, you're probably the least likely person to show clinical signs of cognitive impairment. So really, living a healthy life, protecting your brain from trauma, for instance, you know, using a seatbelt, that is probably, practically speaking, a preventive approach for Alzheimer's disease, because head trauma increases the risk of Alzheimer's disease maybe 2 or 3 times. And similar kind of common sense interventions. There's evidence, for instance, that folic acid may be, people who have high level of folic acid have less brain atrophy or brain shrinkage, which comes normally with age.
Should I take that with a supplement, or are there some foods that are rich in folic acid they ought to eat?
Both. I remember parents used to tell us to eat your greens and your vegetables.
Right.
I mean, there's some sense in that, really, because probably assuming these vitamins and maybe antioxidants may have a protective effect on brain cells. We don't have any research that points to that specifically, but there is some indirect evidence that antioxidants, like maybe vitamin E, may protect people from an accelerated decline.
Although, of course, a study came out a few weeks ago saying that too much vitamin E can be bad for you.
That's true, too.
So maybe
there was an analysis of several
other
studies and analysis, yes.
Right. Okay. We're just about finished here. What motivates you personally to have gotten involved in this, and as you're going forward doing this work?
Personally?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. I got involved in Alzheimer's disease in 1975 when I graduated from medical school.
Right.
As some sort of obscure project.
Right.
And at that time, in the whole world, there were 52 papers published on Alzheimer's disease.
And now?
And now we are talking about 6,000, 7,000 papers published in 1 year on this disease.
Right.
So at that beginning, I got involved primarily purely for doing a research project in academic medicine, which turned out to be eventually very clinically relevant condition as the decades passed, and we became aware that this was not a very rare disease affecting the young people, but very common disease affecting the elderly people.
Right.
I like this, studying this disease, because as you can imagine, it's really memories who defines who we are as
right.
people. The difference between you and me is not in our hearts or livers or lungs. It's really in our life experiences. And when these things start to change, it's the person who changes. It's not really the body who changes.
Right.
And treating the disease, you need to get involved with a caregiver and the family. The effort in the psychosocial issues of the patient and the family are as important as the medical and neurological issues. And really, therefore, we kind of treat the family and the patient as a whole, and I think this is very rewarding, because you get to know the people you're working with very closely.
And would you say that the trend right now is that you're able to help more people more deeply than you have been in the past?
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is the exciting thing, because I had the privilege of looking at Alzheimer's disease when it didn't exist,
right?
And we didn't do nothing for it, didn't
right.
do anything for it, there was nothing around.
Right.
To the point now that we have actual interventions that really improve quality of life. We don't have any cure for it, but we have treatments.
And so, overall, what would you say the prognosis is for the treatment of the disease now in the next five years or so?
Treatment, you mean, and a cure for the disease?
A treatment and cure.
I would say, I hope that, like in many neurological diseases, we'll probably not be able to find a cure for it, but we'll be able to probably have several interventions to put a stop to the progression of it.
Stop to the progression.
Yes.
So essentially, once the intervention begins, people won't get too much worse.
Or there will be significant slowing down so that it does not have a bad prognosis for life like dementia has today.
Okay.
I would say, I hope that the more, I would say, valid intervention will be done in identifying people at risk. Children of people with Alzheimer's disease who have maybe some biological marker. It could be a gene, it could be an abnormal PET scan that could say, well, this person seems to have markers that places them at high risk of getting Alzheimer's disease, so let's treat this person who is just clinically intact and fine at the age of 40 or 50.
Right, and in the same way we spoke about briefly earlier, these new ways of detecting precursors will be accompanied by methodologies of intervening on that basis.
Yes, exactly, exactly, exactly. Yes, we always see. I would say the Alzheimer's research is moving in two lines.
Right.
One is to identify people at risk.
Right.
With markers, genetic markers, blood markers, spinal fluid markers,
right.
Imaging markers. At the same time, there is basic bench work type scientists who are developing pharmacological interventions, vaccine, stem cells interventions, whatever may look promising. And eventually these two lines will join somewhere where we will have something to offer the people identified at future risk.
Sounds good. Thank you for all your work and for explaining it to us here on the Utopia Media Medical News Network. And maybe we can check in a year or so and see how things are going as well.
Very well.
Thank you very much.
Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
Bye. Bye-bye.